If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, the podcast where we unravel the threads of textile artistry. I'm your host, Mr. X Stitch, and today we're diving into an incredible conversation with Caro, an artist who fuses silversmithing and embroidery to create breathtakingly intricate works. In this first part of our conversation, Caro shares her journey from early explorations in jewellery making to discovering the expressive potential of embroidery. We discuss the contrast between working in metal and textiles, the influence of haute couture techniques, and the patience required to craft deeply detailed pieces. Caro's work explores themes of craft, devotion, and the intersection of tradition and modernity, using intricate materials to challenge the boundaries between art, labour, and storytelling. If that sparks your interest, be sure to check out episodes 71 and 72 with Betsy Greer. They'll be right up your alley. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the show. It's great talking with Caro. She's a fantastic artist. And I'll be back next week with the second part of our needle exchange. So until then, enjoy the show. What I wanted to start by asking you was, I did a podcast a while ago with Marcia Bennett Mayle, who is both an embroiderer and a stonemason. And I'm interested when people have different disciplines like silversmith jewelry making and embroidery. Do those two mediums for you form part of a whole creative process, or are they two separate processes that maybe sometimes overlap or are very separate? Can you unpack how all of that works for me, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's twofold. One is that the processes of working are very different, so they need very different materials, different skill sets, though I think fine motor skills are important for each of them. And I do find overlaps in what I need to focus on. But it sort of depends. I also look at it holistically because I see the work and I see both the metal framework and the embroidered tapestry. I worked in metals for a long time before starting embroidery. And so I'm more familiar with that medium, but I felt that it was sort of limiting in terms of color and texture. So I had kind of always identified as an artist, but I was only sort of making jewelry and I couldn't figure out kind of how to break through to a different plane until I came across embroidery and I thought, oh my gosh, this has opened up an entirely new world of color and texture and softness that is really expansive.
Expansive or expensive?
Expensive. No, I would say metal is more expensive than embroidery in terms of the materials.
But then actually, like your embroidery, you've gone really fancy, if you'll pardon me being such a dumb explanation. No. But I mean, you lean into beadwork, goldwork, all of those really rich, beautiful textiles.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did. I studied at École Lesage in Paris. So I studied haute couture techniques. So it is all very elaborate. There's applique, there's ribbon, there's sequins. So it's not necessarily what people think of off the bat when they're thinking of embroidery, unless perhaps you're French, in which case you have a storied history of what embroidery looks like.
Right. And then is there... If you have an idea, is it quicker to execute in metalwork than embroidery?
I mean, if the idea exists only within a metal framework, which that's kind of only occasionally where that happens, it is quicker in metal than it is in embroidery.
Because I was sort of wondering whether there's this tension between the fact that, like, you're working in metal and, like you say, you want to expand the nature of the expressions you can make. So then embroidery, beadwork comes along, gives you all these different formats and textiles and stuff, but then also takes maybe about 3 times longer to fully realise or something. I wondered.
Yeah, like, or maybe like 10 times.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So close. You're like, oh, this is a really good idea that's going to take forever now. How do you qualify that?
Well, I have to choose. Like, I always have ideas flowing and things that I would like to work on, but I have to determine how long that is going to take me and if I can dedicate myself to that and if it's actually worth that devotion, if I'm actually going to feel like I want to stick with, you know, looking at one thing for an extended period of time.
But then I understand that you're an artist who isn't bothered if things take their time. Like, you have a great appreciation of the value of slowness.
Absolutely, I do. But I still have to balance that within, you know, the
laws of time and space, yeah.
structure that we're in. And I took 5 years to make one piece, and that was quite mentally taxing. I felt as though I was never going to finish it. And I did come up against quite a lot of like mental and emotional blocks during that, because the tedium was getting to me, certainly. So,
And why was it that it took that long? Was it the scale of it? Was it the intricacy of it?
A little bit of both. And I didn't really plan it out, so it was pretty much entirely improv, and because of that, you know, each stitch I had to think, okay, is this the right perspective, is this the right color, and I did a section of maybe 6 inches of bouillon, and if you've done bouillon before, you know that stitch takes anywhere from 30 seconds to a minute depending on the humidity and how the thread is knotting. So yeah, it was kind of a perfect storm of poor planning and the techniques and the intricacy. And I would undo and redo things as well because I didn't like certain things.
Okay. So what are your takeaways from that then? What did you vow to do differently off the back of that?
Yeah. So basically, I was very close to finishing and I got a residency in France, and I decided, okay, I'm going to see if I can make 5 pieces in 1 month. So I made all of the metal framework in my studio beforehand. And then when I went to the residency, I only brought my embroidery hook, a limited amount of materials. I didn't bring any embroidery floss. So I only brought machine thread, beads, sequins, a limited color palette. And I was able to make 5 pieces in 1 month. So that really made me feel like, okay, this is something that is feasible. I can create a full body of work, you know, at a time frame or a scale, a pace that is acceptable sort of in the modern world.
Mm. So it's probably a bit of a relief, isn't it, that it's not going to be every single piece is going to be this saga that takes forever.
Right.
So you can't sacrifice it. So what you're saying is you just set yourself quite strong parameters, quite strong kind of limits on where the scope would go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it necessitated a limiting of detail. I still worked quite long days, but I was able to find a new form of expression that was perhaps simpler, but still visually impactful. And I still felt had my voice.
It's kind of funny, isn't it? So my daughters are 5 and 7, and particularly Annie, who's 5, she likes colouring in. And there's a mantra that I keep saying to both of them, which is like, the secret of art is knowing when to stop. Because if I leave Annie, she'll colour and colour and colour, and eventually it'll just be this big black mess, probably just go through the paper. So, you know, but it's that thing. So I wonder whether you then making those decisions and going, this is now good enough. I do, you know, there are cutoffs bound by like the restrictions you put in place.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always kind of a gap between what you envision and what the reality is when you're making art. I think it rarely holds up the tangible to the mental, ethereal. But I think I've, over the years, come to sort of relax that perfectionism within me, because I've still created work that I'm very happy with. And even if it didn't turn out exactly as envisioned, there's still something very beautiful in the labor and the final result. So I used to be quite dogmatic about needing everything to be just so. And mm-hmm. I think with age and also effort, you sort of think, okay, no, that's good. Like I can take off that mantle and appreciate what I've done.
I think life is short sometimes, isn't it? But it takes a while to go, it's okay. Like 80% of perfect is still like pretty blooming good, isn't it? You know?
Right.
But that's quite a bitter pill to swallow, you know? I don't think as a 20-year-old or someone who's, particularly if you've got like a strong skill set, you know, some of the young people I know who are like RSN graduates, like they've got skills. So, and they've been trained to use those skills. But to go, to be that kind of pragmatism takes a bit of, I think it might be age to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Every piece of work, I feel like you go through a dip, you know, like say I'm doing cross stitches on the rare occasion I get to do them. And there's that bit, or if you're running a race, if you're doing anything, maybe like 60% of the way through, you haven't quite got the end in sight and you're just getting quite bored of it. Your piece that takes 5 years then, that must have been quite a dip. And I wonder where, if you can reflect back on like how you soldiered on through that.
Yes. Well, I think by picking up various other skills or trying out various other things. So I got myself a pleater during that time. And so it was fun for me to sort of work with that machine. That I also started bobbin lace at that time. And I remember my teacher saying, you know, this is a very slow medium, you know, be prepared. And I was thinking to myself, this is so fast. I can make work so quickly.
Yeah.
So that was really fun too, because it is sort of like weaving, you know, there's only two methods of working, the twist and the cross. So it's the 0 and the 1 where coding comes from. And so it really took a lot of mental strain off of me because it was just very pattern oriented. So that was something that I would kind of go to if I felt overwhelmed by sort of the fatigue of decision making in the creative work. So it was more meditative.
Yeah, this is the wrong analogy, right? But when you get a blocked drain, sometimes they have to use very thin tubes of high pressure water to start to poke through the block, you know, mm-hmm. to kind of get through it. And it's almost like your bobbin lace is like some creative version of that, isn't it? You make some headway, and the more you make the headway, the more that block becomes a bit more kind of flexible and get throughable or something like that. Like it restores your creative pressure.
Yeah, I think it's sort of just a relaxation of the mind allows, you know, for you to overcome some creative hurdle.
Do you sort of seek out these different media like bobbin lace and stuff like that to sort of feel it out, see how it fits with you, see if you want to incorporate it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was curious about bobbin lace because I was wanting to make a lace jewelry collection, and I had done some crocheted jewelry in the past with 40 gauge copper. So that's about the thickness of a strand of hair. So very thin. And I thought, okay.
It's twisting my melon a little bit. I'm just thinking about crochet. And for a minute, I was like, okay, she's doing it with yarn. And then you've gone, no, hang on. I'm doing it with copper that's as thin as hair. Wait, what?
Yeah. And so I did end up actually making a jewelry collection out of silver and gold thread,
right.
And pearls. But I am hoping to incorporate lace into my embroidery and metal work as well.
That's cool.
It's just another added layer of time, of course.
Yeah, I can dig that. God, that's fascinating. And it is, I really love like the when you get hard and soft things going together, you know. I really, that one of an artist I used to love, she was a needle felter, but she would do things like recreate security cameras and pipe work and all this stuff that looked really hard, but obviously it's made out of wool. And I really love that kind of contrast. So in the same way then, when you're talking about the intricacy of lace, but it's stuff that's made out of like really fine metal. And it's not, we're not talking like gold work thread, are you? You're talking very fine strands of actual metal.
Yes. So I did make some tests with actual very thin gauge wire. And what I found was that it was not only incredibly difficult to hold the tension, because obviously metal and thread have different tensile properties, but I would find that the metal work hardens as you weave it through, and it would then break off. So I ended up using kind of actual thread that is coated to look like silver and gold. And then I would make, you know, posts out of silver or gold. And so there would be metal components in the work, but the lace itself would be thread.
Right. So would it stand to reason, if you scaled that up, if you chose to use metal that was the thickness of wire, I'm going to try and use my science brain for a minute here, best of luck, that would maintain heat for longer, so for therefore might stay softer for longer, which would give you more play with it. Would that be right?
So if I used basically a thicker gauge metal, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, yeah. Or if you scaled it up, you know, if you decided to do it with, I don't know, 2-inch sheets, because, you know, using like the reality of it aside, is it a science thing? Is it a heat and a sort of strength? And
yeah, so all metal will work harden as you put pressure on it, basically, or as you manipulate it, and then you use heat to anneal it, to soften it. So basically the molecular structure of metal basically gets fractured as you hammer it, and you can kind of hear that, or as you work that, and you can hear that in the sound, in the pitch that it makes. But then, yeah, you have to heat it up in order to be able to work it again. Otherwise, it will maintain its rigidity.
Right.
So that carries through whatever thickness of metal you're working with. It just then depends on the heat, the amount of heat that you have to apply is dependent.
A lot of my wisdom in this area comes from a guy called Alex Steele, who's a YouTuber who like makes Damascus, and he's a YouTube blacksmith or whatever. So I've got a bit of an, I did do a silversmithing weekend once where I think I made a very ugly brooch out of silver, which I gave to my wife, and she said, oh, thanks. And funnily enough, I don't know where she's put it. So tell me the journey. You were a jeweller and silversmith before an embroiderer. Tell me how little Caro went to become a jeweller, and then we'll move on to the embroidery bit.
Sure. So I started beading when I was 9. My mom walked by a bead shop on her way home from work, and she thought, I know someone who would like this. And I really did. I loved it. I made tons of jewellery. I ended up having like a little jewellery show when I was 11 at a local cafe, and, you know, made enough to buy myself a laptop.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was quite successful.
Has your mum got any jewelry background? Like, are you the first jewelry person in the family, or is she also quite creative?
Yeah, I'm the first jewelry person in the family. My mom did study art history. Yeah, she just always kind of saw me with my hands playing with pliers. So, yeah, she thought that it would be a good fit.
And there it was. Prodigious talent. Yeah, amazing.
And then my high school actually had a jewelry and metals program. So I started when I was 13 with jewelry and metals there, and I learned so much. I took it every single semester. And then I studied it in undergrad as well. And then I carried on still making jewelry. I worked as a bench jeweler for various different companies when I lived in New York. I also worked as a tassel maker. And then basically I went to this exhibit at the Met. It was an embroidery exhibit. It was called Manus Ex Machina. And it was the hand versus the machine. And I just completely fell in love. I had always loved textiles, and I had kind of wanted to major in textiles at university as well, but I was already double majoring in metals and French and minoring in art history. So there were already a few too many things on my plate. But when I saw this exhibit, I just completely fell in love with the hand embroidery. I felt that there was such a spirit and a devotion, and I felt like I could see the time and emotional resonance in that work. And when I looked at the machine work, while there were times in which it was very impressive, you know, because of the scale, I often felt that my eyes could kind of glaze over it because it felt too perfect. There wasn't the essence, there wasn't the nuance that was so evident to me in the hand embroidery. And of course, there are still so many techniques that the hand can do and that the machine has no capability to replicate. So yeah, I fell deeply in love with the hand embroidery, and there was a plaque that spoke about this embroidery school in Paris that was still working to train hands. And I thought, okay, I have to go. I have to learn this. I have to keep craft alive, which is something that I'm very strongly adamant about.
It's an interesting thing that you said just then about how machine embroidery made your eyes gloss over it, and it was almost because it was too perfect. Mm. Which echoes back to what we were saying before about perfection, and actually maybe part of the appeal about hand embroidery is that that layer of perfection can't be met. And without getting too metaphysical all of a sudden, is that not a reflection of the human condition?
Right. Mm-hmm. Precisely.
That was good. I know that, like, we'll jump around a bit, but I know that, like, as you said, the concept of man versus machine, mankind in relation to God, these are emergent themes in your work. Your work, by the choice of the materials you use, has that ecclesiastical leaning. Tell me, have you got like a broad thesis? Can we dig into that a bit?
Yeah, so I would say that right now, in terms of the theory, I'm looking into the relational aspect between biophilia and matrifocal systems. So,
question. Those are some very sciencey words. Can you use human words, please?
Yes. So biophilia is the idea that humans and the earth are intrinsically connected, that we have a relationship with one another that cannot be extricated from one another because we evolved alongside each other. And then matrifocal systems relates to systems of the matriarchy. So they are non-hierarchical, not predicated on dominance, but are communal, rhizomatic, and there is often a relationship to religion in that, because the earth is the giver of life and women are also the giver of life. So for thousands and thousands of years at the start of our history, you know, God was a woman. She was depicted as the earth, as a gestating earth, you know, work and ecstasy were very closely related. And I find that there is such a devotional aspect to meditative labor that they do coexist in that way.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Obviously, I mean, patriarchy, honestly, what are we doing? Just going to put that whole subject to one side. You see, do you know, it was making me think, actually, is when you do work, when you're in that meditative space and you're making things, I don't think you ever go, like, you don't feel particularly gendery. I don't imagine there are many men. I mean, I know quite a few men who stitch. I don't think there are many men who are just like, oh, yeah, I'm such a man. Do you know what I mean? Do you know, all the dumb machismo, all of that stuff, because men are just primitive beings that were just, I think really we should just serve a function to forward the creation of the species and then be eaten alive like praying mantises do or something. It would make the world a lot simpler. But it's that thing of actually creativity isn't a gender thing, is it? It's a human being. It's a very pure form of existence in that space.
I think overall, yes. But I do think there is evidence to support that women are the creators of most art and culture. To what you were saying, the female is primordial, in that in the beginning it's just sea and single-celled organisms reproducing parthenogenetically, which is where an egg and its own polar body meet, and so there's cloning that happens. And the male doesn't come into existence until thousands of years later in the age of reptiles, when it seems as though the female thinks, oh, it would be good to have some genetic variance here.
Right.
And there are still species that clone themselves. The whiptail lizard, for example, is an all-female species. And we can also see this actually in sex, because the male has sex and can only have sex for reproductive purposes. And the female has sex mainly for bonding, affectional bonding. You know, that's because, of course, we've created a menstrual cycle, which also is cyclical and is in communication with the natural rhythm of the world. So I would say, you know, the first tools come from women, they're digging sticks, the first form of communication. Language is formed in women's communities because men are going out to hunt and you need to be silent when you are tracking an animal. But if you are rearing children, you are connecting with them. You are giving them facial expressions. Babies often will move their legs in rhythm to the woman's voice.
Right.
So I would say overall, women create fire, women create the tool, women create language, and women are the first potters, women are the first weavers, women are the first metal workers. So I would say there is...
I'm not feeling under threat here, by the way. This is fine. Go for it.
I would say there is some feminine dominance there. That isn't to say that it is gendered in modernity.
It makes me wonder whether men were a bit like AI. Like, it was an experiment, and they were like, oh, do you know what? I don't think it's working. But by then it was too late, and we're just running all over the place, being idiot men things, you know, getting killed by mammoths or something. And you're like, oh, for God's sake, can't get them back now. That's really fascinating. It's a really fascinating... So, I mean, I'm guessing you've done a fair whack of research in this respect then.
Yes. That is sort of where my research is focused at the moment.
So then you've got a view on the whole... I don't know, because I talk about it, I guess, because I meandered into, like, the world of needlework in my 30s, and I'm a man, and then I like cross-stitch, and cross-stitch has got this heavy gender marketing thing that's been going on for, like, 200 years, and then you find out embroidery is the same thing, and then you go, oh, well, actually, men have decided that we make art, and ladies just make crafts and hobbies and stay at home and all of that. So, you know, completely trying to just go over the thing. Like, what's your perspective on the whole men make art, women stay at home and do crafts? Bullshit kind of philosophy. What's your take on all of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's sort of just reflective of the social hierarchy and how the patriarchy views women. I've definitely gotten varying responses to my work, and when I introduce myself and say I work in embroidery, women will often say, oh, I took a class once when I was 10. And first you think, okay, well, this is my career, though. There's like a bit of a difference. You know, if you introduced yourself as an author, I wouldn't say, oh, I kept a journal once.
yeah.
You know, but yeah. Sort of the more I thought about it, the more I realized that women really do have such a response to textiles as a medium. And I think that is because it's matrilineal knowledge. It is being passed down from grandmothers to mothers to the female line, you know, like we're the ones that are in the home, we're the ones that are mending. And if we look at that socially, when Europe moves from a system of feudalism into capitalism, when we're in feudalism, we have the commons, and that is land that is used by the peasants who are under the landed gentry to create their, you know, their sustenance, to trade economically, you know, and they're given housing and protection by their lords. But women run that land. When we move into capitalism and we are now suddenly required to work for a wage, we don't just get to live and, you know, eat our food that we make. We have to also find some kind of payment. Women, because we are rearing children, are by necessity less mobile. So we are within the home, and men are able to kind of be out and about. They are able to go into towns. They are able to
work hard for the money.
Right. They're able to make the wage however they see fit. Women are forced to find economic recompense in the home. And what can you do in the home while also having children about? Textiles. So this is where this homework comes from, because it's also lucrative as well. You know, everyone needs a blanket. Everyone needs to be kept warm. And this is also where our stories come from. You know, we're not just stitching beautiful things. We're also relaying our history and how we spend our day. And so I do think that it's important to venerate and valorize that this is women's work. While men can and do participate, of course, I think that we should be honoring that and certainly not denigrating the value of women's work or, you know, kind of classifying it in a negative sense as domestic, because that is an incredibly important realm, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. So there's a couple of things it's making me think. The point that you're talking about where you switch from feudalism to capitalism, the problem is we use the term capitalism and suddenly you think like big industrial capitalism, but you're talking pre that, aren't you? Where
early the stage.
Yeah, and so the capacity then when industrialization comes along and suddenly a lot of the things that the women were doing in homes and cottage industries and all those sorts of things, they get factorized, don't they? They get scaled up and suddenly you have to go out to work. Mm-hmm. And if you can't go out to work, then you stay at home because you're child rearing. So the gap widens, doesn't it? And the ability for women to even do those things diminishes because of the domestic requirement. Then on top of that, you get men going, well, we're working here and I've made my way to the top and I've done the business and aren't I marvelous? And then you get a sort of unconscious marketing layer that starts to appear, don't you? That just says, we're the men, we're in the factories, we've had all this success. And it just keeps like the story naturally unfolds, doesn't it? That just puts women in their place in the home and almost that second grade because I've got a pocket watch that I am from working at the factory or whatever. It's all quite a natural misunderstanding in some ways, isn't it? That then gets taken a bit too seriously.
Yeah, well, and I think also what would be interesting to note is that with the increased mechanization, children, this is when child labor becomes really dangerous, because the machines need to be kind of configured with very small limbs.
Yeah.
And so this is when children are put to work in really, really dangerous situations. And there are mass graves all around the old factories. But this is also where the Luddite movement comes from, because the textile workers were the first people to say, like, wait a minute, you're trying to mechanize our labor. You're trying to tell us that we have to stand at command. We have to work for someone else when we've been working for ourselves and, you know, being able to take breaks when we want to and keep our children happy and sustained at home. I don't think so. And this is where sort of consciousness starts to rise up in the 1800s. And the pretty amazing thing about the Luddite movement was that it was very, very well supported. No one snitched, basically. And then unfortunately, basically they would go around to factories and they would smash the mechanized looms. They would keep the old traditional looms. They wouldn't touch those. But with a blacksmithing hammer, they would go around and they would break these machines. And basically what happened, unfortunately, was there was one sort of violent military event. Then the higher ups sort of realized, okay, we can break down this movement with enough force.
And we've got lots of money.
And we've got lots of money, right, exactly. And so, unfortunately, absolutely everyone who was involved in the Luddite movement was killed.
It's bonkers as well, isn't it? Because when you're called a Luddite these days, it's used as a term to suggest someone who's a bit afeard of technology.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying, though, is that they weren't necessarily afeard of technology. They were just trying to defend the way the technology was being applied and the fact that it was like dissolving indigenous modes of working that have been doing fine, thanks.
Right. And exactly. So what is the point of efficiency if it's not to make everyone's lives better? If the only point of it is to line a few people's pockets, then that is something that we should be questioning. And, you know, it obviously still has
I was going to say, well, I'm glad we fixed that problem then. Let's not go down the old... Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NEEDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.